This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Esther. Now here's Pastor Sandy as he teaches through Esther chapters 1 through 4.
There are a lot of ways to get a wife that are in the Bible, but that doesn't make them biblical. Just because an event is recorded in the Bible doesn't necessarily make it God's will. The Bible also records the foolish deeds of mistaken people. Remember that. Hey, rather than get a wife in today's world, interviewing girls by taking them to bed is a good way to get an STD or a broken heart or a cheapened sense of dignity and self-worth or a ruined reputation or a crumbled integrity. Hey, the biblical way to get a wife is to keep yourself pure and to trust God to bring you your mate, for God can do a much better job of it than you can. Well, verse 15 tells us, "Now when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her and made her queen instead of Vashti." Esther wins the rose. How about that? She wins the contest. The name Esther means star. And Hadassah became the star of the king's harem. Imagine, out of 400 gorgeous girls, the pick of Persia, an exiled orphan, the great-granddaughter of a conquered Jew, ends up the queen of the empire. It was a grand example of God's providence. You know, down through the ages, it is amazing how the Jews have been elevated to positions of prominence. Statistically, the world's Jewry is a small percentage of the total human population. And yet, the Jewish impact far exceeds its numbers. Of the four most influential people of the 20th century, Marx, Einstein, Freud, and Darwin, all were Jewish except Darwin. Over 100 Nobel Prize winners have been Jewish. Here's a list of some Jewish celebrities: Barbara Walters, Larry King, Woody Allen, Sandy Koufax, who can forget him? Sandy, a guy named Sandy. Henry Kissinger, Mark Twain, Barbara Streisand, Kirk Douglas, Jerry Seinfeld, Bob Dylan, Ben Stiller, Judge Judy, Dr. Laura, etc., etc., etc. And this isn't accidental. God has blessed the Jews even in their unbelief. Verse 18. "Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther," he called it, "for all his officials and servants. And he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king." Rather than Christmas, it was Esthermas. And they gave gifts to each other. I mean, you get the impression here that this king is in love. And he just wants to kind of spread the love around. You know, let's give gifts. Let's be generous to one another. Verse 19. "When virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her." Again, she was afraid. Apparently, anti-Semitic sentiment was as great a threat then as it was throughout the history of the Jew. You know, God's providential blessing on the Jewish people has produced an envy and a spite in non-Jews. Mark Twain called anti-Semiticism the swollen envy of pygmy minds. But it's more than that, really. Hatred for the Jews is not your ordinary, run-of-the-mill form of prejudice. The Bible tells us that Satan is the ultimate source of anti-Semiticism. If Satan can't harm God directly, he will assault God's chosen people. He'll go after God's kids. What else can explain the relentless brutality against the Jewish people that has been a staple of human history, from the Romans to the Crusades to the pogroms in Russia to Hitler's Holocaust? Last week, we visited Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem. And it was gut-wrenching to see the intense hatred that the world has fostered against the Jews. The only explanation for history's relentless onslaught on the Jew is a satanic conspiracy. And the survival of the Jews is a direct result of God's providence. What's amazing about the story of Esther is God's faithfulness despite Esther and Mordecai's unfaithfulness. You know, despite throughout the book, our hero and our heroine are guilty of numerous violations of God's law. The most obvious here is that Esther is willing to marry a pagan king. Ahasuerus worshiped the god Zoroaster. And as we move through the story, we're also going to find that Esther fails to keep the Jewish dietary laws. She fails to keep the Sabbath. She fails to keep the feast days. And she felt none of the moral conflicts with these pagan practices that upset Daniel while he was in Babylon. You remember, he had conflicts with these things. Esther seems to have just glided right through. Queen Esther was quick to compromise. Rather than be a witness, she covered up her godly heritage. Understand, Esther represents the Jews of the diaspora, both then and now. At the time, backslidden Jews lived all over Persia, but God providentially protected them. And for the last 2,000 years, this has been the plight of the Jew. For the most part, the Jewish people have lived compromised lifestyles in foreign lands. And yet, despite that, God has been faithful to ensure their survival and even their prosperity. It's interesting, the word God never appears in the book of Esther. This is the only book of the Bible void of the name God. And yet that sums up Esther and Mordecai and many of the diaspora Jews. They were Jewish, but their Jewishness was more ethnic and racial than it was religious and practical. This describes most Jews today, especially Jews in Israel. They hold to their Jewishness as a patriotic fondness and as a fervor without trying to keep the law or, for many, even believe in God. Bible commentary, Alexander McLaren, he writes along this line. He says, patriotism is more evident than religion in the book of Esther. To the Jews in Persia, national feeling was stronger than devotion. They were what we would call secular Jews. And what better description of the modern Jewish state of Israel? They're patriotic, but they're very far from pious. They're loyal to their race, but not so much to their religion. You see, the book of Esther is a blueprint for how God has dealt with the Jews for the last 2,000 years and with how he's dealing with Israel at this moment. Even though they've been unfaithful to him, he has still been faithful to them. His providence has ensured their survival and is even ensuring their prosperity today. He's caused the land of Israel to prosper, turning a desert into a breadbasket. In numerous wars with the Arabs, God has provided the Jews supernatural protection. Most Israelis today fail to recognize their Savior. But that doesn't mean that their Savior isn't watching out for them, just as he was in the days of Esther. The survival of the Jews to this very day is evidence of God's wonderful providence. Well, at the end of chapter 2, Mordecai uncovers a plot to assassinate Ahasuerus. Verse 21, in those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Secular history tells us that these two men were planning to put a poisonous asp in the king's ale, get him drunk, then drop a viper in his vodka. Talk about a drink with a bite. Rather than pass out, he'd just pass away. And so the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther. And Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Mordecai was hoping to get some credit for this. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. The whole matter gets recorded, but not rewarded. And I'm sure Mordecai was disappointed that the king had not acknowledged his life-saving snitch. But as we'll see, God had a purpose. Hey, God always has a purpose. Well, in chapter 3, enter the evil villain, Haman. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. Now you can remember Haman's name and his nature by associating Haman with Hitler. The two go together, don't they? Phonetically and also philosophically. They both hated the Jews. Notice Haman was an Agite. You remember Agag was the king of the Amalekites, the ancient enemies of Israel. Hitler killed 6 million Jews, and Haman would have killed several million more if it weren't for Esther and God's providence. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him, but Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Mordecai is a Jew with chutzpah, and he refuses to bow to anyone but God. His Jewishness just won't let him bow. Well, then the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" Now it happened when they spoke to him daily and he would not listen to them that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay homage, Haman was filled with wrath. And Haman decides to retaliate, but notice the form his retaliation takes. Verse 6. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. He doesn't just plan to eliminate Mordecai. He wants to exterminate all the Jews. Haman realizes that Mordecai's defiance was typical of his people. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is, the lot, before Haman to determine the day and the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Now, Haman decides that the day of the Jewish genocide should be determined by casting the Pur, or the lots. And so he rolls the dice. And guess which month turns up? The 12th month. Now, it's the first month at the moment, but the 12th month gets chosen. And this is no accident. For what this does is it gives the Jews a year to undermine Haman's plan and to prepare to defend themselves. See, if the dice had pointed to the very next day, it would have been a disaster. But again, God's providence took control of those dice. It was God, not Haman, that set the date. Proverbs 16, verse 33 is a great verse here. The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. Well, then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other people's, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries." Haman's even going to pay the executioners out of his own pocket. And so the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money and the people are given to you to do with them as seems good to you." And tragically, King Ahasuerus signs off on Haman's heinous plan. Well, the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded. To the king's satraps, to the governors, which were over each province, to the officials of the people, to to every province according to its script and to every people in their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring, and the letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces. As a side note, Persia was renowned for its postal service. They had this tremendous communication network and postal service by which the king could send out his decrees and the people would be assured of getting it. It was very unique in the ancient world. Their couriers delivered the instructions to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. A mass genocide of the Jewish race is ordered by the king. A copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, that they should be ready for that day. The couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Shushan was perplexed. Ahasuerus and Haman have a toast. The Jews are toast. The king was probably drunk when he agreed to the deal in the first place. And it didn't take long for Mordecai to hear the news. Chapter 4. When Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went as far as the front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. And many lay in sackcloth and ashes. They just couldn't believe that a death sentence had been ordered against them. And so Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her. They told her that Mordecai was in sackcloth. Evidently, they didn't tell her why. They didn't tell her about this death sentence on the Jews. And the queen was deeply distressed. Then she sent garments to clothe Mordecai and to take his sackcloth away from him, but he would not accept them. He wants Esther to know this is not just a situation they can gloss over. This is serious. Then Esther called Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend her. And she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the city square that was in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. Evidently, the members of the king's court were the last to get the news. Mordecai also gave Esther's messenger a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given at Shushan, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication to him and plead with him for her people. So Hathach returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai. But Esther isn't so sure that Mordecai's suggestion is a good idea. For then Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, he has but one law, put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter that he may live. A good way to eliminate distractions, huh? Interruptions. And yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. Ahasuerus was a powerful potentate with an ego as big as his empire. And he had a rule, don't interrupt. All overtures were by appointment only. Enter the king's chambers without observing the proper protocol and you could lose your head. If the king didn't point the golden scepter at you, oh my, it was curtains for the intruder. And besides, it had been 30 days since Esther had even seen the king. For all she knew, he might be angry with her. Or worse, your highness might be high. Vashti could tell you, when King Ahasuerus got drunk, it didn't fare well with the women folk. Esther was afraid. And so she sends word back to Mordecai that a visit to the king is not the greatest idea. Verse 12. So they took Mordecai, Esther's words. Then Mordecai told them to answer Esther. And his words to Esther have become immortal. Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. Esther, don't forget, you're a Jew also. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? In other words, providence always has a point. Guys, God positions us for a purpose. God worked out the circumstances for you to get that job that you currently enjoy. It didn't just happen by chance. The Lord in His providence opened the door. There was no way you could have got financing for that house, but God did it. God got you into that class that had already been filled up. It was a miracle. You made the team, and you don't know how in the world it happened. Obviously, God had to have opened the door. But now that the door is open, and now that the job is yours, and now that you're a neighbor, and now that you're in the class, now, what are you going to do with that opportunity that God has given you? Hey, providence always has a point. God positions us where we can serve Him and be most effective for Him. Hey, God puts you where you're at for such a time as this. There's a person there that needs to be loved. There's a stand there that needs to be taken. There's an example that needs to be set. And God has providentially positioned you to be the answer to that need. He set you up to shine His light and His love and His truth in that place. Remember, providence always has a point. Verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." What a display of true commitment and courage. As Esther goes back and forth with Mordecai's suggestion, she's counting the cost. At first, she wants to keep her head in the sand. Finally, she's willing to lay her head on the line. She agrees to risk it all in order to step up for her nation and for her people. If I perish, I perish. Esther considers the worst case scenario, but she's still ready, even if it costs her life. And if Esther was this devoted to the Jews, how much more should we be devoted to the King of the Jews, Jesus Christ? How much do we love our Savior? Jesus died for me, but am I willing to die for Him if need be? What about die for Him daily to my own selfishness and to my own self-centeredness? So often we're intimidated by a mere sneer. We become the brunt of a joke and we back off in our witness. Someone mocks our faith and we become timid. This isn't Esther's job on the line. This isn't her popularity on the line. This isn't some boy she wants to date on the line. This isn't an impression she wants to make on a customer on the line. This is her very life on the line. And yet she is willing to give it up for the cause. This should be our devotion for Jesus Christ. If I perish, I perish. But I am not going to back down, and I am not going to compromise my faith and my stand for Jesus Christ. Do you have that kind of faith and commitment to Jesus? Verse 17. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. He and the Jews in Shushan, man, they started to fast and pray.
Listening to Bible teaching here on the radio is a huge blessing that many of our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world simply don't have. We rejoice in this opportunity to share Pastor Sandy's messages with you. We do want to be sure to remind you that radio is not a church. Radio should be a complement to what God is already doing in your personal discipleship through the local body of believers that you're a part of. Maybe you're listening today. You don't have a home church. You've visited various places, but nothing seems to fit. First, if you live in the Atlanta, Georgia area, we want to personally invite you to join us for worship at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain. We meet every Sunday morning at 9:30 and 11:15 a.m. For more information, including driving directions, please log on to sandyadams.org and follow the link to the church website. Now, if you're listening outside of the Atlanta, Georgia area and are looking for a home church, we encourage you to log on to calvarychapel.com and find a Calvary Chapel in your area that teaches through the Bible, just like Pastor Sandy does each day here on this program. Well, we wish we had more time today, but we've come to the close of today's broadcast. Be sure to remember to join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through God's Word. That's next time on Sandy Adams Radio.